Chapter 36. Married. Landon and I were married the same day as peace was declared in the Crimea. Landon told me it was to save on the fee for bell ringers. I looked around nervously when the vicar got to the bit about speak now or forever hold their peace, but there was no one there. I met with the Bronte Federation, and they soon got used to the idea of the new ending, especially when they realized that they were the only people who objected. I was sorry about Rochester's wounds and the burning down of his house, but I was very glad that he and Jane, after over 100 years of dissatisfaction, finally found the true peace and happiness that they both so richly deserved. Thursday next, a life in Speshops. The reception turned out to be bigger than we thought, and by 10 o'clock it had spilled out into Landon's garden. Boswell had got a little drunk, so I popped him in a cab and sent him to the Finis. Paige Turner had been getting along well with the saxophonist. No one had seen either of them for at least an hour. Landon and I were enjoying a quiet moment to ourselves. I squeezed his hand and asked, "Would you really have married Daisy if Briggs hadn't intervened?"
"I've got those answers you wanted, sweet pea."
"Dad?" He was attired in the full dress uniform of a colonel in the Chronogard.
"I've been thinking about what you said, and I made a few inquiries."
"I'm sorry, Dad. I've got no idea what you're talking about."
"You remember? We spoke about 2 minutes ago."
"No." He frowned and looked at us both in turn, then at his watch.
"Great Scott!" he exclaimed. "I must be early. Damn these chronographs."
He tapped the dial and left quickly without saying another word.
"Your father?" asked Landon. "I thought you said he was on the run."
"He was. He is. He will be. You know."
"Sweet pea," said my father again. "Surprised to see me?"
"In a manner of speaking."
"Congratulations to the two of you."
I glanced around at the party still in full swing. Time was not standing still. It wouldn't be long before the Chronogard tracked him down.
"To hell with SO12 Thursday," said he,
divining my thoughts and taking a glass from a passing waiter.
"I wanted to meet my son-in-law."
He turned to Landon, grasped his hand, and sized him up carefully.
"How are you, my boy? Have you had a vasectomy?"
"Well, no," replied Landon, vaguely embarrassed.
"How about a heavy tackle playing rugby?"
"No."
"Kick from a horse in the nether regions?"
"No."
"What about a cricket ball in the Ghoulies?"
"No."
"Good. Then we might get some grandchildren out of this fiasco. It's high time little Thursday here was popping out some sprogs instead of dashing around like some wild mounted piglet."
He paused.
"You're both looking at me very oddly."
"You were here not a minute ago." He frowned, raised an eyebrow, and looked about furtively.
"If it was me, and if I know me, I'd be hiding somewhere close by. Oh, yes. Look. Look there."
He pointed the corner of the garden, where a figure was hiding in the shadows behind the potting shed. He narrowed his eyes and thought through the most logical train of events.
"Let's see. I must have offered to do you a favour, done it, and come back but a little out of time. Not uncommon in my line of work."
"What favour would I have asked you to do?" I ventured, still confused, but more than willing to play along.
"I don't know," said my father. "A burning question that has been much discussed over the years, but has, so far, remained unanswered."
I thought for a moment. "How about the authorship of the Shakespeare plays?" He smiled.
"Good point. I'll see what I can do."
He finished his drink.
"Well, congratulations again to the two of you. I must be off.
Time waits for no man, as we say.
He smiled, wished us every happiness for the future, and departed.
Can you explain just what is going on?
Asked Landon, thoroughly confused, not so much by the events themselves as by the order in which they were happening. Not really.
Have I gone, Sweet Pea?
Asked my father, who had returned from his hiding place behind the shed. Yes.
Good. Well, I found out what you wanted to know. I went to London in 1610 and found that Shakespeare was only an actor with a potentially embarrassing sideline as a purveyor of bagged commodities in Stratford. No wonder he kept it quiet, wouldn't you?
This was interesting indeed. So who wrote them? Marlowe? Bacon?
No, there was a bit of a problem. You see, no one had even heard of the plays, much less written them.
I didn't understand. What are you saying? There aren't any.
That's exactly what I'm saying. They don't exist. They were never written. Not by him. Not by anyone.
I'm sorry, said Landon, unwilling to take much more of this, but we saw Richard III only 6 weeks ago.
Of course, said my father. Time is out of joint. Big time. Obviously, something had to be done. I took a copy of the complete works back with me and gave them to the actor Shakespeare in 1592 to distribute on a given timetable. Does that answer your question?
I was still confused. So it wasn't Shakespeare who wrote the plays?
Decidedly not, he agreed. Nor Marlowe, Oxford, De Vere, Bacon, or any of the others.
But that's not possible, exclaimed Landon.
On the contrary, replied my father. Given the huge timescale of the cosmos, impossible things are commonplace. When you've lived as long as I have, you'll know that absolutely anything is possible. Time is out of joint. Oh, cursed spite, that ever I was born to set it right.
You put that in? I asked, always assuming he was quoting from Hamlet and not the other way round. He smiled.
A small personal vanity that I'm sure will be forgiven Thursday. Besides, who's to know?
My father stared at his empty glass, looked around in vain for a waiter, then said,
Lavoisier will have locked on to me by now. He swore he'd catch me, and he's good. He should be. We were partners for almost 7 centuries. Just one more thing. How did the Duke of Wellington die?
I remembered he had asked me this once before. As I said, Dad, he died in his bed in 1852. Father smiled and rubbed his hands.
That's excellent news indeed. How about Nelson?
Shot by a French sniper at Trafalgar.
Really? Well, some you win. Listen, good luck, the pair of you. A boy or a girl would be fine. One of each would be better.
He leaned closer and lowered his voice.
I don't know when I'm going to be back, so listen carefully. Never buy a blue car or a paddling pool. Stay away from oysters and circular saws, and don't be near Oxford in June 2016. Got it?
Yes, but...
Well, Pip-Pip, time waits for no man.
He hugged me again, shook Landon's hand, and then disappeared into the crowd before we could ask him anything more.
Don't even try to figure it out, I said to Landon, placing a finger to his lips.
This is one area of special ops that it's really better not to think about.
But if...
Landon, I said more severely. No. Bowden and Victor were at the party too. Bowden was happy for me and had come easily to the realization that I wouldn't be joining him in Ohio as either wife or assistant. He had been offered the job officially, but had turned it down. He said there was too much fun to be had at the Swindon Literatex, and he would reconsider it in the spring. Finisterre had taken his place. But at present, something else was preying on his mind. Helping himself to a stiff drink, he approached Victor, who was talking animatedly to an elderly woman he had befriended.
"What ho, Cable?"
Victor murmured, introducing his new-found friend before agreeing to have a quiet word with him.
"Good result, eh? Balls to the Bronte Federation. I'm with Thursday. I think the new ending is a whiz."
He paused and looked at Bowden.
"You've got a face longer than a Dickens novel. What's the problem? Worried about Felix Eight?"
"No, sir. I know they'll find him eventually. It's just that I accidentally mixed up the dust covers on the book that Jack Shit went into."
"You mean he's not with his beloved rifles?"
"No, sir. I took the liberty of slipping this book into the dust cover of The Plasma Rifle in War." He handed over the book that had made its way into the prose portal. Victor looked at the spine and laughed. It was a copy of The Poems of Edgar Allan Poe.
"Have a look at page 26, said Bowden. "There's something funny going on in The Raven."
Victor opened the book and scanned the page. He read the first verse out loud.
"Once upon a midnight dreary, while I pondered weak and weary, o'er a plan to venge myself upon that cursed Thursday next, this air affair so surprising gives my soul such loathe despising. Here I plot my temper rising from my jail of text. Get me out, I said, advising, pluck me from this jail of text, or I swear I'll wring your neck."
Victor shut the book with a snap.
"The last line doesn't rhyme very well, does it?"
"What do you expect?" replied Bowden. "He's Goliath, not a poet."
"But I read The Raven only yesterday," added Victor in a confused tone. "It wasn't like this then."
"No, no," explained Bowden. "Jack Shit is only in this copy. If we had put him in an original manuscript, then who knows what he might have done."
"Congratulations," exclaimed Mycroft as he walked up to us.
Polly was with him and looked radiant in a new hat.
"We're both very happy for you," added Polly.
"Have you been working on the bookworms again?" I asked.
"Does it show?" asked Mycroft. "Must dash."
And they were off.
"Bookworms?"
asked Landon. "It's not what you think."
"Mademoiselle next?"
There were two of them. They were dressed in sharp suits and displayed Speshop's 12 badges that I hadn't seen before. "Yes?"
"Préfet Lavoisier, Colonel Gendarmerie, où est votre père?"
"You've just missed him." He cursed out loud.
"Colonel next. Et un homme très dangereux, mademoiselle. Il est important de lui parler concernant ses activités de trafic de drogue."
"He's my father, Lavoisier."
Lavoisier stared at me, trying to figure out whether anything he could say or do would make me help him.
He sighed and gave up.
"Si vous changez votre vie, contactez-moi par les petites annonces du Grand Oui. Je lis toujours les archives."
"I shouldn't count on it, Lavoisier." He mulled this over for a moment, thought of something to say, decided against it, and smiled instead. He saluted briskly, told me in perfect English to enjoy my day, and walked away. But his younger partner also had something to say.
"A piece of advice to you," he muttered, slightly self-consciously. "If you ever have a son who wants to be in the Chrono Guard, try and dissuade him."
He smiled and followed his partner in their quest for my father.
"What was that son thing about?"
asked Landon. "I don't know. He looked kind of familiar, though, didn't he?"
"Kinda."
"Where were we?"
"Mrs. Park Lane,"
asked a very stocky individual, who stared at me earnestly from two deep-set brown eyes. "SO12. I asked, wondering quite where the little beetle-browed man had sprung from.
"No, ma'am,"
he replied, seizing a plum from a passing waiter and sniffing at it carefully
before eating it, stone and all.
My name, Bartholomew Stiggins, with SO13.
What do they do?
Not at liberty to discuss,
he replied shortly.
But we may have need your skills and talents.
What kind of... But Mr. Stiggins was no longer listening to me. Instead, he was staring at a small beetle he had found on a flower pot. With great care and a dexterity that belied his large and clumsy-looking hands, he picked the small bug up and popped it in his mouth. I looked at Landon, who winced.
Sorry, said Stiggins, as though he had just been caught picking his nose in public. What the expression? Old habits die hard.
There's more in the compost heap, said Landon helpfully.
The little man grinned very softly through his eyes. I didn't suppose he showed much emotion.
If interested, I'll be in touch.
Be in touch, I told him. He grunted, replaced his hat, bid us both a happy day, inquired about the whereabouts of the compost heap, and was gone.
I've never seen a Neanderthal in a suit before, observed Landon.
Never mind about Mr. Stiggins, I said, reaching up to kiss him.
I thought you were finished with special ops.
No, I replied with a smile. In fact, I think I'm only just beginning.